Twilight Roundtable.
Bonus episode.
Hello and welcome to a special bonus episode of Reality Exploit Roundtable. My name is Voodoo and I'm happy to be joined by a couple of the regular panelists for Reality Exploit Roundtable. And today we're going to tackle an interesting topic, just one topic, and that is, what is agorism? Now, in our pre-recording discussions on whether we should even do this episode, I don't think any of us missed the irony of us putting together a gospel of agorism according to Reality Exploit Roundtable. We don't purport to be the end-all be-all of agorist thinking, and actually it would be a tragedy if we were. There's a lot of agorists doing a lot of great agorist work every day, and we don't presume to talk for them. In fact, I'm pretty sure that of the regulars on Reality Exploit Roundtable, not all of us call ourselves agorists. So to a certain extent, our title and our topic is more of a hook. We want to explain what agorism is, what the terms used in agorism are, and how they apply. Just as a little background, agorism has been used as an umbrella for a broader set of terms and concepts that really don't lend themselves well to an elevator speech. And so that's led some critics and proponents of agorism really to set up a straw man version of agorism that is overly simplified, I think. The straw man they set up is that agorism means doing business on the black market, only on the black market, and not voting. Plato just, you know, as a simple answer here, is that what agorism means?
No, that's too simplistic.
Okay, well, we got that out of the way. What we can say is the purpose of this episode is to give a tool to both critics and proponents of agorism that they can use to frame their discussions. A little more in depth than the straw man, obviously, but we can reduce agorism down to just a handful of irreducible parts, and it makes more sense that way, I think. To start, we have to go to counter-economics. So despite the name, and it might be a bad phrase of turn, but counter-economic transactions are economic. They are man acting in the realm of scarce resources. However, there are differences between counter-economic transactions and what we would normally, what we would call a normal transaction. Plato, you want to give us the difference and the difference between a counter-economic transaction and what we would normally call an economic transaction?
Sure. So counter-economic, the basic connotation here is that a counter-economic transaction is one where the participants don't include the state. So normal transactions, if I go and rent a house, some of the money is ending up in the state's pocket. And same thing if I accept a wage from an employer who's registered with the IRS, he's going to take money out of my paycheck. And the state's participating in that transaction, and my employer and I are allowing that to happen. Now, on the other hand, if he pays me under the table, so to speak, if he hands me a wad of cash, the state is not involved. They don't see that money. They don't take taxes out. So an under-the-table transaction would be counter-economic. So would any transaction where you just have two people trading without involving a state.
Yeah, I think that's the important part there is the specific exclusion of the state in a transaction. The example I always use is you go to a dry cleaner and you are paying taxes on the transaction with the dry cleaner. But then there's also the overhead, the government overhead. You don't do a signed contract with a dry cleaner. You just come in and drop off your clothes. But the implicit contract there is that we'll use government courts to settle any dispute that we have.
Sure.
Whereas a counter-economic transaction avoids those deadweight losses.
Another one would be that the dry cleaner shop owner is paying property taxes on his premises, and he's probably paying income tax on the money that he makes. And because of those extra costs, he's forced to raise his prices a little bit. So if he was dealing outside the government system and he had a black market shop for dry cleaning goods, he might be able to offer cheaper prices because he doesn't have those deadweight losses, as you say.
Yeah. But along with that, we also gain an element of risk in a counter-economic transaction. Obviously, if we're specifically excluding the state in the transaction, that by, you know, de facto makes it an illegal transaction according to the state. They want to be involved in every transaction. They would be involved in who you date and who your friends are if it was up to them. So given that we have this increased risk, Smuggler, why would anybody participate in a counter-economic transaction?
Well, there are a couple of reasons for that, and I can only speak from my own personal view on that. And that is, number one, for me, it's simpler. I mean, even with the risk of detection and jail and whatever, you have a simpler life most of the time. You know, when you have set up the thing and you know the risks and you have mitigated the risks, it's often a much more hassle-free and more moral thing to do. I mean, for me, it's really about morals often, where I say, you know what, it's two parties to a transaction. That third party, it's only breaking down on the social relationship between the buyer and the seller. So those are two of my reasons. It's more hassle-free when you're into it, and it's something that is really much more ethical, so to speak. The other thing, of course, is that you can, if you frame it right, you can have good profits. I mean, depending on where you're coming from and depending on how you can optimize your business, you can get lots of taxes. And depending on your tax volume, that can be enormous. I mean, if you think about places like Germany or Spain or something like that, you have a value-added tax around 19 to 25%, I think. And that covers for a lot of risk. And the other thing is that there is nothing risk-free anyways, you know? So even if you are thinking that you're all legal and everything, the IRS can come in and tell you that you're wrong. And you can, you know, involve detention risk by mistake. So it's not really that different when it comes to risk. I mean, today everyone is a criminal, more or less. And for me, counter-economics really means to really embrace being outside the system and not being naive about what the state will do to you.
Fudo, you're asking why would people participate in counter-economic transactions, and it's a cost-benefit analysis. As Smuggler is saying, one of the benefits is that you are paying taxes, so you have more money. Another benefit for him is that it's simpler, and a cost is that there's some increased risk of detection and fines or jail. So obviously, different people are going to assign different values to the non-monetary parts of that. Some risk-averse people are not going to be willing to trade with somebody else without involving the state in that transaction.
Yeah.
Right, and it's a personal thing for every participant in the counter economy to really balance those risks and to find out how high the probability of being caught and how much value is lost by being caught and how bad it is. So essentially you take your probability of damage and you take the damage or the amount of damage and combine that with the cost of risk mitigation, and then you find out if you're still making a profit and it's still worth it. I mean, there are things in the counter economy that I personally wouldn't do because they're far too risky. Even if I say they are ethical, they might be too risky for me. On the other hand, with a little bit of thought and grasping reality, you will find out that many of those risks are really overblown by the state media. I mean, the state really wants to scare people into the state economy. And analyzing risks and analyzing the probability of getting caught, analyzing the damages that really come from it, will show you that there's a lot of counter-economic business you can do without really facing death or immediate death.
You know, one thing that strikes me is that, I mean, we're trying to define agorism here, and I think a big part of it is that agorists would like to increase the, I guess, economy of scale to such a point that this cost-benefit analysis of a counter-economic transaction makes it very beneficial to opt out of the state. If everybody is trading without the state, then it'll be, you'll have less risk of detection and you'll have higher profits than if there's only a few people who are involved in counter economy.
Which remains to be seen.
That's true. I can hope.
Those are all good points. And from an economic point of view, actual go to school economics course, from an economic point of view, the fact that agorist transactions do occur means that, you know, it takes two parties to the transaction, to a counter-economic transaction. They have to have reverse valuation, and they both have judged that benefit as being greater than the risk, and they both value the fact that they're doing business with the specific exclusion of the state. I mean, that's just part of the what they're demonstrating by the transaction, don't you think?
What does it mean if both parties have reverse valuation? Is that just saying they've done the cost-benefit analysis?
It means if you and I are trading a tie for a pen, I've got a tie and you've got a pen, and we decide to make a trade, what we're demonstrating in that trade is that you value the tie more than the pen you had, and then I value the pen more than the tie that I had. If we didn't have those reverse valuations, then we never would have made the trade, because it would have made us worse off.
Unless you have some other thing in there. If you're holding a gun to my head and you're saying, you gotta trade me the pen for the tie, otherwise I'm gonna shoot you, now that's an extraneous cost.
That's not economics, that's politics.
Yeah, exactly. That's that. You know, we're really talking about voluntary transactions here. But even in that case, Plato, what I'm doing there by using force is just changing the valuation on you. It's the tie plus not getting shot in the head is worth more to you than keeping the pen and taking a shot to the head.
And one should keep in mind that the gun, so to speak, that is put at your head exists in the non-counter economy, in the state economy as well, except that it's both parties having a third-party gun to their head. Another thing I'd like to add is that counter economy can be asymmetric. That means that maybe just one of the parties is actually facing risks through doing counter economic transactions. For example, and that's a big example, but it's the first one that springs to mind, is when it comes to prostitution in Sweden. In Sweden, prostitution, to offer prostitution, is legal. So for the hooker to sell her services is very, very legal. What's illegal is for the John to hire her. So it's, when it comes to that transaction, it's clearly a counter-economic transaction, but only one of the parties really faces the risk in that regard.
I guess a parallel would be a pot grower and dealer who's selling pot to somebody on the street. The guy who's growing it and selling it has higher risk of incarceration, and he'll face a longer term in jail than the guy who's just buying a gram of pot.
Exactly.
Interesting. And I'm glad you brought up the force. It's my experience that when people say agorism, what they really mean are counter-economic transactions. But there's more to it. There's the force of the state is involved, and so that leads us into what gets us to agorism from counter economics. And with everything in libertarian thought, we start with the non-aggression principle. Smuggler, what is the non-aggression principle?
Well, it's really simple. It means that by principle, you will not use aggression, which is the use or the threat of physical violence against someone else, unless you're defending yourself. So essentially, it means that you should live a peaceful life. I mean, you're not out there to be a bully. You're not out there to force your will on people, but instead you persuade them by arguments and offers that do not involve violence. And it's kind of the basic, well, let's say the basic universal ethical claim that most civilizations formulated one day or the other, and that is, don't do to someone else what you don't want to have done to you. You know, so it's a golden principle or whatever, and it simply means do not use force unless you have to defend yourself against force.
Good enough. There's obviously people with objections to the non-aggression principle. Even some libertarians object to it. They don't reject it, but they don't like the non-aggression principle being the end all be all. They think there's more beyond that. People who rely on the non-aggression principle are described as vulgar libertarians. In that, look, it's I divide the world into two types of property: property that I own, property that I don't own. I can do whatever I want with my property, but the rest of that property in the world, it doesn't matter to me who owns it or what type of property is it, public property, private property. I just don't own it, and I don't have any say in what's going on there.
Yeah, the world would really be peaceful if everybody would agree with you that.
Well, and then that's the deal. A lot of libertarians want to act as if the non-aggression principle should be applied universally, as opposed to a principle that you internalize and act on yourself. They want to hold other people to that standard. But does that work, Plato?
Well, I think you kind of have to do it that way if you're talking about more than a couple people interacting. If you're talking about a whole society, it's not really going to be enough to just say, all right, there's no rules, it's total anarchy, and we really hope that everybody follows the non-aggression principle, because there are going to be bad guys who are, violent for the sake of being violent and hurt each other. So you have to have some sort of justice system, some sort of rule of law that is applying the non-aggression principle to aggressors, even if they are not willing to accept that. Because, I mean, I guess it seems self-evident to me, if they're not willing to accept the non-aggression principle and they aggress, that doesn't make it all right.
Well, I would like to add that the non-aggression principle actually brings you profit, even if you're doing it as the only person on the planet. I mean, it's something that, as Voodoo already said, that starts with the individual deciding to adhere to it. And I think that you make yourself and your own life better by not being an aggressive person. I mean, there's this saying, you know, that violence always brings counter violence, whatever. But essentially, I think that life gets much more easier and much more streamlined and much more peaceful already if you're the only person that adheres to the non-aggression principle. On the other hand, I do actually think that the non-aggression principle can work on a societal scale, but it means that people. That the society does not have some built violence. We have built-in violence in our societies right now. For example, the tax system. The tax system actually says we are using violence against people to get their money to distribute it to other people. So that is a built-in aggression to the system. But when it comes to crimes, I mean, like real crimes, like people running around shooting people. You don't have to let the non-aggression principle go away to battle that, because the non-aggression principle still allows you to defend yourself, and it still allows for a justice system. It just doesn't allow for sting aggression. It has no problem with defending.
Here's one possible counterexample that I sometimes struggle with. What if you have a society that is largely accepting the non-aggression principle, and for the most part, like society itself, there's no systemic things like taxes that are aggression. But what about when some crazy guy ends up with a nuclear weapon? He's not using it on anybody, and he hasn't even threatened to use it on anybody, but once he uses it, it's too late. this is like kind of parallel to the current situation with the U.S. and Israel saying Iran may one day have a nuclear weapon, so we gotta stop them. How would you guys handle that?
Well, can we rephrase your question to just say some sort of weapon that would cause mass damage? I don't think the current nuclear framework is analogous or in any way applicable. Nukes are like pyramids. You can't have them without slaves.
Yeah, that's fair. Let's rephrase it to any potential mass weapon. It could be something as simple as, you know,
a virus.
Maybe one day you'll be able to, print out a virus on your 3D printer or some nanobots that'll just wreak havoc.
I think that the non-aggression principle is not a promise of a utopia where there's no problem. Weapons of mass destruction, just a difference in scale, not, you know, something, a difference in quantity, not so really in quality. And they are comparable to other weapons. You know, the question of if your weapon kills 1,000 people or just one person, is not really a difference in quality. So if I have a gun and you don't have a gun, and I suddenly drag out my gun and shoot you, and I do that in a split second, then you're dead. And it's the same thing with a nuclear device. The non-aggression principle doesn't offer you a place that will always be safe. And if you compare it to the real world, then you will find that even our world right now, which has aggression everywhere, is not a safe place. It's actually a totally unsafe place, and the biggest threat is, in my opinion, the state of the current form. So what I'm saying is that there's no real, there's nothing really different with the nuclear device or something like that when it comes to threatening people with violence. It's the use of the weapon, in my opinion, that is the problem. It's not the existence of the weapon. And as you can see today, we have today all those devices, but they're also used because there is a legitimate argument, at least in the mind of the statists, that aggression, which is the use of those weapons, not in defense, but, you know, in starting aggressively, is all right. So I think that we don't really have to solve the nuke problem or the weapon of mass destruction problem, because the overall argument for aggression and non-aggression principled society already is reduced.
And there may be some sort of insurance scheme, just spitballing, some sort of insurance scheme where if you made the precursors public knowledge to who owns what precursors that could develop something like this, the insurance would require you to put out put up a bond to even hold that material on the off chance that you would use it, and then survivors would be able to tag that bond.
That's getting closer to what I was trying to ask, which it's like, can you preliminarily use force to, like, take away the precursors or make these people pay for possession of the precursors or take away their plague vial or their nanobots or whatever before they actually use it to cause mass destruction? Because after the fact, after they set off the nuke, I mean, sure, you can punish this one guy, but the damage has already been done.
Well,
I defer to what Smuggler said there, is if you, that you wouldn't be able to use violence to take it away from them, but you can certainly increase the cost of holding things like that to make it so that you would have to be crazy and a gazillionaire to be able to afford it.
I think there's another thing that needs to be kept in mind, and that is that the non-aggression principle kind of asks of people to really get the world as it is. Right now, without the non-aggression principle, we have this myth of state aggression being there protecting us against the bad guys that might come along. And in my opinion, that's a very, very stupid thing to delegate your security to the state exclusively. And I think, especially when we're talking about non-kinetic weapons, like That's, for example, the virus, the biological agent that kills us all. I think technology is not something that really changes the political philosophy. Technology is something that demands from us that we adapt to technology with our own technological behavior. So, in my opinion, if we would live on a planet where everyone is crazy and building viruses, and we are not, then it would be very, very smart to protect yourself on an individual basis against that. And it's something we actually do without noticing. For example, most people actually lock their front doors to protect themselves against burglaries or rape or whatever. And it's a smart thing to do. The police will only be there to wipe the floor after you have been robbed and killed. So we simply have to adapt our self-defense and our self-action, our lifestyle to technology, and not believe in the fantasy that some kind of state and sometimes of some kind of societal order will actually take away everything that's bad.
Yeah, let's take this back to today in 2012. If you are someone who internalizes the non-aggression principle, it seems to me that's an individual statement. In other words, the non-aggression principle is unique. I cannot force anyone else to accept the non-aggression principle, can I?
No, by definition.
That would actually be a paradox.
Yeah, I think it would be a paradox. I think the non-aggression principle is just a simple statement. I will not initiate force or fraud against any persons or property. It's that simple. But there may be an opportunity for me to network or structure my personal relationships to take mass ma to the extent possible to take maximum advantage of other people who internalize that statement, and we would call those people agorists. So smuggler, what's the benefit to me of structuring my relationships that way?
Well, that really depends of if you like a peaceful life, and I personally do. So, structuring my relationships around people that are predetermined to live peaceful lives increases my peace, and it also increases my ability to predict directions. For example, if I have a lot of non-agorists around me, I will never be sure when they're calling the state and asking for his terror to solve whatever problem someone perceives. So essentially, it reduces the parties to any transaction, every social transaction, every economic transaction, any transaction at all. It reduces it to two people that actually can have a meeting of minds. So for me, structuring my life around other agorists or at least non-aggression principle people means to have a more honest, more peaceful, in a way, a little bit more predictable life that insulates me a little bit from the terrors out there.
Smuggler, are you saying that if your counterparty in a trade decides to involve the state by suing you or something, would you say that's a violation of non-aggression on their part? They're committing aggression against you by calling in the big guns?
It really depends on if that was part of the contract beforehand. But yes, I would actually say that if the other party calls for the state to do anything, that is a violation of the non-aggression principle. Because the state itself will operate on terms that I have never agreed to, and most likely the other party hasn't agreed to either. And it funds the whole thing by aggression through taxation and so on and so on. So yes, I do think that another party calling in the state for anything does violate the non-aggression bill.
I like your point, though, that it's smart to specify in the contract beforehand so there's no confusion and explicitly say we'll make this a counter-economic transaction and we're not going to involve the state.
Right, that is very smart.
So if assuming I did have a group of friends or a group of agorists, people who accepted the non-aggression principle, Plato, is that dispositive proof that they will never, ever, ever aggress against me?
Yeah, well, actions speak louder than words. If they've aggressed against you in the past, that's a mark against them. If they've aggressed against others in the past, that's another mark against them. And if you don't know anything about this guy and he just says, oh, I promise I won't hurt you and I won't call on the state, well, you know, now you have no marks for or against. You only have his word for it. And maybe you can go and ask his friends, is this guy trustworthy? And hopefully they're trustworthy themselves and they give you true information. But really the only way for you to have a strong assurance that you won't be the victim of aggression from somebody else is to trust them. And maybe that's because you've had dealings with them before and you have a working relationship. Or maybe it's because there's a mutual trusted party who says, oh, I promise, you have my word that this guy's good, and you trust him enough to go for it.
I think there are additional risk mitigation strategies for that. If you're talking about the context of non-aggression and counter-economy, then both parties have to have a larger room to play when it comes to how exactly they're structuring their relationship. And that usually means, at least from my experience, that there's more flexibility on how trade is conducted, which allows both parties to involve things like tradecraft, for example, to involve things like using mutual escrow systems. So you can actually create a situation where it's less likely that you are defrauded or aggressed against by other means, simply because people are more aware of that they have to take matters into their own hands. But of course, there's no guarantee like that. I mean, there's no guarantee for anything in life.
Sure. Okay, so with those three pieces in place, counter-economics, the non-aggression principle, and agorists, I think we can finally get to answering the question that we started out with, Smuggler, is what is agorism?
Well, agorism as a term was defined by Samuel Edward Conkling III, great name in my opinion, and he wrote a New Libertarian Manifesto. And what he outlines is the concept of agorism. And he uses the word agorism in two ways. And the one way is agorism as the description of a society that purely exists based on voluntary interaction. It borders a little bit on anarcho-capitalist or mutualist utopias. That is essentially what he wants. But he also uses the term as a description on how to get there. And he essentially says, okay, the current state we're in, statism, that sucks. There's violence everywhere. There's inefficiency everywhere. It doesn't really work. And we want to live in a world where every transaction is mutually voluntary. And so he says, okay, let's use certain means to get to that society. And those means are counter-economics, is splitting yourself on an individual basis, doing transactions that involve the state as a party to contracts. He has his examples for that. He defines different kinds of markets, and that's a little bit beside the point. But the next point, the next important thing about the term agorism then is that by using counter-economics and by more and more people that use counter-economics and cooperate with each other, sooner or later, the state becomes more and more irrelevant to the marketplace. And that sooner or later, by means of both economic versions, but also by funding security services through the counter-economy, the state is, so to speak, crumbling and not able to take back his territory by force.
Sure. And Plato, what kind of odds would you give on the scenario that Sam Konkin outlined? What kind of odds would you give on that actually going through the phases as he described them?
Well, I'm hopeful. I think that his end goal of a voluntary society where people are dealing with each other and not involving a state, that's It's what I'd like to see. And I think that we're getting closer every day, especially with recent technology. So we can use, Tor to encrypt our communications and make sure that Trapwire and the rest of the state's surveillance can't read those communications. And that's, very helpful for getting the state out of our deals. And Bitcoin helps us get money out of the hands of the state. And open transactions is promising to bring contracts into, the realm of peers. And I think we can use that to further this end goal of, an individual society. It's interesting because Konkin wrote all this way before this technology existed. So he still had this vision of it working without the internet and everything. I think we can get there.
To me, it seems like a far-fetched thing, but what odds would you give, Smuggler?
I actually don't think that the end goal of algorithm is realistic, because it assumes that the majority of economic and social power actually agrees with the non-aggression principle. And I am kind of the pessimist when it comes to humans here. I do think that there are quite a few people that are very, very happy with delegating a lot of problems to the aggressive institution we call the state. And so I don't really think that agorism will, in totality, so to speak, be implemented anywhere but certain small areas. But it won't be something that will have national territory covering something like Europe or the United States. I am very, very pessimistic there. However, I don't think that we have to reach that total perfect implementation to make us more free. I mean, it would be a lot if places, the size of Hong Kong or something like that, actually implement that and survive. That would be a lot. And I think that is realistic, but I don't think it will be something that will be implemented on a global scale.
That's fair. I'll refine my previous answer and agree with Smuggler, because I think we can get to the stage where you and I can deal with each other in an agorist fashion without involving the state, like, ever. I think that we can probably find a community somewhere that does abide by non-aggression principle and doesn't involve a state. But I do agree that it's going to be a very long, hard road to convince those who do love the state that it's in their better interest to not deal with the state.
I actually think it's for a long, or a big reason for the struggle we're in is really different kinds of mentalities. And I think that there are good reasons from the side of statist for the state. And there are very little arguments for someone who's used to outsource aggression that there should be an anti-aggression. And there's this notion from some scientists, I forgot the name, who essentially said that theories not really replace other theories, but the people that hold those theories are replaced by simply dying off over time. So I think that is one of the big problems. The other problem is we live in a world that for most of its history has operated some kind of aggressive society. And I think there's a reason for that. And that reason is not just enlightenment, but I think it's character traits of people. And I am just happy if I can reach that stage, as you mentioned, Plato, where I personally can live in a small society where most of my transactions or all of my transactions are based on peace and voluntary interaction, and have a society that is open to all with the same wish without having to hope for everyone agreeing.
I guess this is kind of the meat and potatoes of this talk here. Does that still count as agorism if not everybody like if the state's still there, but all the agorists are trading counter-economically and living happily. I think some of the people who are against agorism are using smuggler's objection that it's unrealistic to bring agorism to the masses, as it were. But what do you guys think? Can we still say it's agorism if it's not total?
Well, I think you're right, Plato, that is the heart of what we're trying to get at here today, is that the term agorism, it's been misused when, you know, the words counter-economics and agorist, I know it's tough to use agorist without having some sort of definition what agorism is. Counter-economics, people banding together based on a mutual appreciation of the non-aggression principle, those are agorism to me. Whereas I think agorism is just SEK's vision of a possible scenario, and I would agree with both you guys that scenario is not very likely, but that we will see pockets of agorist counter-economic activity, and it will be it'll be profitable, will flourish, and the states are not going to like it. We already see in Greece where capital flows are leaving towards Switzerland. Greece is trying to claw that money back. We see in states around the world right now people. States trying to claw back money from offshore tax havens. If agorists doing counter-economic transactions ever deprived the state of enough victims, they would come back full force, and they would they have no chance of collapse because someone will always be trying to resurrect the idea of the state.
Yeah, I would like to add to that, and that is by comparing it to other strategies for liberty. I think the one big mistake anyone who loves liberty and peace, the one mistake we can really do is to think that the struggle for liberty is over someday by having liberty and always having liberty. I don't think that there is something like liberty that is once implemented and ever there. Liberty is something that has to be defended by the vigilance of everyone wanting it, and has to be re-implemented on a personal level from day to day. I mean, every day, every one of us who loves liberty needs to live a life of liberty and to defend the liberties he has. So when you compare it to all the other strategies, this question of will we be an end goal of liberty, far from agreeing on liberty, really what liberty really is, all those strategies are faced with the probability that liberty ends again, and that liberty is not universal. And I think it's against the nature of liberty that we create a totalitarian liberal place, you know, where everyone has to be libertarian, where everyone has to love peace, and so on and so on. We are individuals, and individuals have multiple motives, and we will always have. There will not be this static utopia where everything is fine and dandy and good. And neither voting nor agorism nor any of these other strategies will us ever get to the libertarian haven of peace and prosperity for all, unless we are really making it a lifestyle and defending it all the time.
And it's worth adding that a lot of people who do inside the system activism, whether they're politicos, they're going to vote themselves peace. People coming to New Hampshire for the Free State Project, those people in their personal lives are practicing agorism as I would define it, that of agorists doing counter-economic transactions. A husband and wife are basically a counter-economic transaction. You are basically agorists. Well, it depends on your marriage, I guess. but everyone has some relationships in their life that are based on a trust, and a trust that this person won't aggress against you. So having said that, why don't we take a look at the straw man that we started off with then, and I think we've defined it well enough. Let's look at some of the claims, some of the objections that are made from the straw man, and see if they hold up against what we've defined here. Smuggler, true or false? Agorism is a strategy to smash the state.
Yes and no.
Would you care to elaborate?
Yeah, sure. Yes, as defined originally, it's a strategy to smash the state. As it's practiced today by most people I personally know, it's not the goal of agorism is not to smash some state, but it's to live freely now.
Smashing the state is just a happy side effect of a whole lot of agorists acting counter-economically and dealing with each other.
Exactly.
And I would personally, I would disagree with you, Smuggler, that smashing the state is no part of agorism, no matter what definition you give it, whether you use SEK's scenario or whether it's you and I doing agorist things in counter-economic fashion. The state holds the seeds of its own destruction, if you will. It uses its aggression in its monopoly on violent force, and whenever a monopolist acts like a monopolist, they tend to displace themselves. So I don't think it's smashing the state so much as depriving the state of victims, and as opposed to John Galt style of depriving the state of victim. In this case, we're depriving of workers.
I'd like to just jump in there, and the reason is that I think there is a confusion between the currently implemented state of name A and the concept of state. Yes, the current implementation of every state holds the seeds of its own destruction and actually nurtures them and makes them grow. And the more it is state, the more it destroys itself and every longing. However, we have seen in history over and over again that states fall out of economic reasons, social reasons, whatever, but they're usually not replaced by an agora, but they're replaced by another state, another implementation of the concept, and everyone claiming this time we're doing it right. Of course, that never works. It's like serial rape. You know, one rapist goes away, but that doesn't mean that all rapists are gone.
All right, two things. First off, maybe there is some version of a state that does provide for individual liberty and justice, and it would have to be, you know, pretty different from what we see today. But I'm not willing to entirely discount, you know, the communists and mutualists and everybody, because in any society you need some system to provide justice and order, and a lot of people are going to call that a state, even if it's not practicing aggression. Like, even if they're just the guys who you voluntarily give your money to pay for the roads and your protection, it's kind of a de facto state. And secondly, I really don't like the imagery of smashing the state because it's so violent, and I really prefer the term subvert, because subvert means undermine the legitimacy of an organization. And that's what I as an agorist want to do, because I want to show everybody through my actions that trading with other agorists counter-economically is profitable and it's better than involving the state. And if enough people get to that same conclusion as I, then you have subverted the state because nobody really gives a shit about it anymore.
Plato, I love that word subversion. I mean, that's really a key word in my opinion, because you can subvert successfully without replacing it completely. So when it comes to, is agorism a strategy to subvert the state, I would fully and 100% agree, and great word, man. Really good.
Yep, me too. I agree with that.
Okay.
Plato, can there be a purity test for agorists?
I guess so. If somebody claims they're an agorist but calls in the state, that's, as I said, a mark against them. And I would hesitate to call them agorists if they're not willing to abide by their contracts and they're not willing to abide by non-aggression.
How about somebody that drives on state roads?
No, you're just taking advantage of their generosity.
How about somebody that uses an internet connection that was from an ISP that's got a contract with the city?
Hey, you gotta do what you gotta do. I mean, I would personally look for at least a VPN to make sure they're not looking at my traffic. But if the service they provide is adequate and it gets me where I want to go, I mean, I'm gonna take it. I guess some other agorists or might they might be offended and say, "Oh, dude, you gotta go with the free ISP." Maybe I'm poor. Maybe I just can't afford the free ISP, and my motives are still pure.
Yeah, I think we have to go back to the counter economics discussion where, and to some extent the agorist discussion where you have to do the cost benefit analysis. If it doesn't benefit you to do something in a counter economic way, it's not a sustainable action. It's not something that you could continue to do. And so, not driving on the state roads is not a sustainable action, in my opinion.
Yeah, maybe I feel bad about driving on state roads or using the state-funded ISP, but as you say, if I have to do it, I have to do it.
I think the purity test, if there should be something like a purity test, is not so much about what are you currently using, but it's more about what do you want to keep in place. And for me, someone who's a role model agorist would be someone who really thinks about freeing more parts of the economy from the state. So having more of a progressive developing view on the world. So if I'm currently not able to use the internet without involving the state, then a good agorist would probably think about how can I make it happen to free the internet from the state. And if there's an option that I can pay, or even if it costs a little bit more, I mean, liberty is a cost as well, then I use that alternative. But when there's no alternative, I actually belong to the people that say, you know what, you have to survive, you have to get along. And for me, most public property is not property, it just waits to be homesteaded.
Okay, I got one for you here, Smuggler, and this one is the one that always causes the fights that I've seen. True or false? Agorism ideologically binds agorists to non-voting.
If you're using agorism and the ideology of agorism as SEK3 said that, then yes, I mean, part of his ideology was to not vote. And he writes so. Personally, I don't think that doing counter economics really means that you have to not vote. Personally, I think that voting is really bad. In my opinion, voting and the non-aggression principle are in conflict with each other, no matter who you vote for. So the SEK stand would be, yes, voting is non-agorist. The smuggler stand would be, voting is breaking the non-aggression principle. But I think the real stand is, it's unrelated.
You agree with that, Plato?
I agree that it's unrelated, and whether you vote or not doesn't necessarily have anything to do with whether I am good with my contracts and whether I commit aggression. I disagree with Smuggler that voting is a violation of NAP.
Yay, disagreement.
I mean, obviously, whoever I vote for is going to be a part of the state, and they will support aggression. But some support it less than others. If I vote for Ron Paul or Gary Johnson, I am supporting less aggression than I would be if I vote for Obama or Romney. And again, in my personal cost-benefit analysis, I would rather throw a vote towards one of the libertarian guys, and realistically, it's not gonna reduce the amount of aggression that the state commits, but it chalks up one more vote on the, CNN report of, oh, look, there's all these guys who are getting a little upset with the really blatant aggression that's going on with the Democratic and Republican parties in the US.
Yeah, I would also take a Spooner view of voting. There is such a thing as voting in self-defense. However, I still wouldn't vote even if it was in my self-defense. But that has nothing to do with agorism. It's just I also don't play three-card Monty on the streets because I know it's a rigged game and there's not much involved with that. Okay, Plato, we kind of touched on this earlier, but I think we should formally address it here. True or false, counter economics is synonymous with doing business on the black market.
Well, synonymous means that they're identical. White market is generally accepted as meaning state-approved transactions where you're explicitly involving the state and paying your taxes and everything. Black market traditionally means the same thing as counter economics. You are dealing without involving the state. There's a third category of gray markets, which are like kind of questionable activities, and you usually don't involve the state, but the state might get their paws in that market at some point. So it really does boil down to, are you involving the state or not? If so, it's counter-economic.
I think there's a good distinction that was made, and that is the red market, which is a non-state approved market, but also a market that deals in goods that are aggressive, like contract killings or something like that. And I think that most people think that black market includes stuff that is aggressive as well. And I would say that counter economics excludes those parts. So, if black market is just defined as non-aggressive, non-state, then counter-economics is black market.
That's interesting. I've never heard that term. So, if I'm trying to hawk sweatshirts on the street that were made in a sweatshop with coercive labor and unfair wages, I could see how that would be a violation of NAP. But it's kind of questionable because, I mean, the sweatshirts are now in my possession, and if I'm trading them to you and I aren't committing any aggression. But there's kind of this aggression in the background that's already happened, and I could see how that would taint the our transaction.
Right, the producer of the slave labor sweatshirts on the sweatshops, that would be a red market business, and in my opinion, it'd be counter economics.
We might not know about it though. I might have got the sweatshirts from a third party, and neither of us have any idea that it came from this red market. So, from a practical standpoint, I mean, at that point, if neither of us know about it, it's basically the same as if they're, honestly produced sweatshirts, as far as we know.
Right, it's as always when it comes down to definitions, definitions don't have to really match reality all the time. So yes, there's a so to speak an orange area where the red markets and the black markets intersect and where people are unaware or unable to differentiate. And I think that that is true for everything. I mean, we are in only very few cases we're really able to make real good distinctions and draw lines in the sand and say this is where it stops and ends. So I think that counter-economic operators should try to stay out of red business, but I don't think that it will always work.
One option would be to create a third-party agency that investigates the sources of the goods that you're selling and that you're making. And you get their stamp of approval that says, "We promise this wasn't made with sweatshop labor." And that stamp of approval will actually add value to your product because there will be people who out of the goodness of their hearts and their own desire to follow NAP, they would rather purchase honestly made goods than red market goods. And as you say, it's a lack of information in the market. If you can't tell, then you can't price that information into the products.
Right, the counter economy means it's something like fair trade. Let's call it the black trade label of approval.
I like it. What's interesting to me is the examples you guys are giving in the I guess the framework that you're talking about are agorists doing counter-economics, but counter-economics can be done by non-agorists also, can't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you kind of become an agorist by working on the black market, in my opinion. You're an agorist for that time, so to speak. And of course, people that are unaware that they're doing that can still operate on the black market, even if they don't have an ideology behind it, why they're doing it.
So if my brother takes wages from an employer under the table and he's not paying taxes on these, it's a counter-economic transaction, and he is furthering the goals of agorism by keeping that money out of the hands of a coercive state, even if he doesn't self-identify as an agorist. So here's that dichotomy again of this political philosophy of agorists believe that by trading counter-economically we can subvert the state, and there's just the simple action of practicing counter-economics that is furthering the subversion of the state, even without my brother realizing it.
Which actually makes agorism the oldest and most successful anti-state strategy ever used.
And yet, look at all the states we have. Smuggler. This is an old one that I haven't heard in a while. I think people have graduated from it, but let's address it anyway. Agorism is going off the grid.
It can include the off the grid part, but it doesn't have to. Personally, I'm a big fan when it comes to becoming independent of state-controlled networks of goods and services and energy and water and whatever, because it helps you being more independent and being able to do more black market business. But it doesn't force you to be off the grid.
So when I say off the grid, you're taking that as either a state produced or produced through a state contract type service?
No, actually, when I'm thinking off the grid, I'm using the notion of being able to provide certain necessities for yourself in a small community or something like that. I actually think that networks like water and power and communication are one of the main tools the states currently have to control us. It's those networks and control over the hubs of those networks that really give leverage to the suppression and oppression that the state can use against us. So I think it's smart to disentangle from them, not to rely on them, but not relying is different from never using.
So going off the grid is another way of furthering the goals of agorism.
Exactly.
Here's a moral quandary for you. What if I buy some solar panels and I think that there's a box I can check on my tax return that says, oh, I'm using clean energy, give me some money. If the state gives me money for installing these solar panels, am I committing aggression by taking that from the people that were taxed, or was all the money just printed out of thin air anyway and it's just free money?
Well, I'm not the Pope and moral authority of agorism. So it's just my personal opinion in what I do. I personally think that every time I have to ask the state for a tax return because I bought something that he funds is actually a failure of my agorist practice already. Because to get back money from the state, you first have to pay taxes. And I try to limit my tax costs so much that there's nothing they could ever return to me.
I agree with that. I said at the beginning that I don't even think all of us call ourselves agorists. Plato, do you call yourself an agorist?
Yeah, I do. I first heard the term when I was exploring Reddit. I started on /r/anarchism, and it's a total shit show. It's the most statist anarchist community I've ever seen. They really have something against anarcho-capitalists. So with all the aggression from the people who are like banning anarcho-capitalists and everything, I went and checked out the anarcho-capitalist subreddit. And from there, I ended up on the agorist subreddit. And I really liked what I saw because it was a community of people who are agorists, as we've been defining it, they furthered these goals of agorism, of counter-economic trading, to bring about a society where individuals can trade without the state. And that's a good enough definition for me. I didn't read Conk, and I didn't know about this further idea of, oh, agorism implies that everybody has to be agorist and the whole state should be totally gone. I didn't even hear about that for months after I started calling myself an agorist. And I'm still willing to say that I'm an agorist. Yes.
Okay. Smuggler, I'm pretty sure you don't use agorist to talk about yourself, do you?
Yes, usually I don't use the term for myself, simply because I don't fully agree with the definition, or actually because the definition is so murky, I try to tend to stay away from the term. I also am not the guy that is really good in putting labels on himself. I disagree too much, and I change my opinion too much that it really doesn't make sense to put a label on myself.
You know, as far as labels go, agorist isn't really the primary label that I would put on myself either. I would say first and foremost, I'm a market anarchist. I think that using free markets to distribute resources is the most just and the best way to go about distributing resources. And, you know, there's some Venn diagram involving agorist and market anarchist and anarcho-capitalist. I couldn't say exactly where I fall, but I would call myself all three of those.
Yeah, I call myself a peace-loving carbon unit.
Nice. Nice. I wouldn't shy away from agorist. If someone called me agorist, I wouldn't use it as a term to call myself, unless you know, somebody that I knew what agorist meant. But what I call myself is an economist. You know, I do have a degree in economics, and I follow the data and wherever the data leads me. And if that led me to statism tomorrow, then get out of my way. But so far, the data has led me to anarchism and agorism. But I don't think, or I think all of us would call ourselves prospective residents of the second realm. Smuggler, you co-wrote the Second Realm book on strategy. Can you explain to us what is the second realm?
Well, the second realm is a book on how to combine several different strategies into one. And for the clear goal of creating pockets or bubbles of liberty where we can implement our ideas about knowledge, for example. And it's mostly about mixing and combining crypto anarchy and tradecraft and temporary autonomous zones, and also countercultural development to create places in time and space where liberty reigns.
Where did the term Second Realm come from?
Gosh, I'd love to know that. I can't really remember. But the current answer I would give is that I divide the world, so to speak, in two realms, the first realm and the second realm. And the first realm is where most people most of the time exist, and that is the realm of the state, where their interactions and their thinking and whatever relies on the system of an aggressive state. And this, the second realm, so to speak, is the other place, the other system that exists in parallel that we're building, where people implement liberty and implement peace and implement voluntary interaction.
And I think at least to me, the lure of the second realm, as you described it, goes back to something we were talking about earlier, and that is agorism or agorists doing counter-economic transactions flourishing in pockets. And that's something big in your book, talking about temporary autonomous zones, places where agorists can freely interact with each other in a counter-economic fashion and go together to defend themselves against state aggression.
Exactly. I mean, the big point about Second Realm is that it's something I believe can be done right now without the agreement of the masses. It's something that happens or can happen with very, very few people agreeing to things like that and binding together. My preferred definition of anarchy, just to introduce the term, is that anarchy is the free and voluntary association of people into groups of their choosing. And Second Realm is really about that. It's about groups that we choose to join, that share our values and that are productive together, that create places, both digital and physical, where we have our parallel culture of more freedom and peace-oriented living. Even if the host culture doesn't agree.
So Plato, if we were going to contrast, say, the non-aggression principle or people who accept the non-aggression principle with Smuggler's idea of the Second Realm, I would say, or wouldn't you say, or would you agree that the non-aggression principle is the individual affording freedom for everyone else, but the Second Realm is then that same individual saying, and I'll take my share of freedom also.
Yes, and I guess a little bit more. Smuggler was saying that anarchy is groups of people associating freely. And Second Realm is where you have individuals, multiple, who are cooperatively grasping freedom for themselves. It's, you know, the difference between one brick and the whole wall. It's, you know, the micro versus the macro. If you have a community of many people who are taking their liberty and combining it with others' liberty, you can do a hell of a lot more than just one individual. So I see Second Realm as this this wall of many people who are interacting, you know, to build the future, the next paradigm shift. The Second Realm is really the best term I've ever heard for it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think Smuggler, in that book, you captured a lot of the activity that, without it specifically mentioning anything, you captured a lot of the activity that's going on around the agorist community, such as it is. And it turns out there's a lot of work being done right now, both in the crypto anarchist community and the cypherpunks, and then just day-to-day people doing day-to-day things in a counter-economic fashion. I think you captured the essence of that, and did away with some of the things that Sam Konkin wrote into the New Libertarian Manifesto that were kind of superfluous. It really didn't have anything to do with his primary thesis.
Can you repeat, please?
Yeah, I think you, in the Second Realm book, you did away with some of the superfluous pieces that Sam Konkin included in the New Libertarian Manifesto that really don't have anything to do with agorism, such as the non-voting, such as the, I don't know, he went off on truckers using CBs to to avoid speed traps and things like that. But with Second Realm, you get away from that and you take a lot more security-focused approach, it seems.
A more practical approach towards the same end goal.
Right, but the thing is, I didn't invent this. You know, I just put a name on it and put together the things that have happening for a long time. And the goal of the whole thing was to make it known for people that are using part of it, but having an idea what else is there. And it really is something for me where I don't want to tell other people really how they should live and how their society and culture should look like. I can only say that for myself and for my people. And I think that with what technology gives us, with the different be it encryption, be it 3D printing, be it automation, and so on. And with all that has been given to us by either people that have made much more interesting and original thoughts, when it comes to tradecraft or temporary autonomous zones, it's just we and I'm speaking grandiose words now here. We as a people have all those things in our hands, and we can combine them, and we can create something, each one for ourselves and for the people we agree with, that implements more of the world and more of the society that we need, and not so much go into a big grandiose political strategy that wants to change all the world and put one kind of rules on everyone.
Yep. All right. Is there anything else you guys want to add to what we've done so far?
I can't top what Smuggler just said, so I move away in there.
I would actually like to add something, and that is a personal position I have, and that is there's a lot of talk can do, and what really matters is not talking but doing. And it's very, very interesting to see how much people have already done and what is done. And if you imagine what all those people that are talking could do together in implementing alternative institutions, alternative justice systems, alternative currencies, temporary autonomous zones, if you transfer all that into productive use, we could make probably a big leap towards a more peaceful society for ourselves. And I would actually think that we need something like the aristocracy of action, where we really get down to it and say, let's do it, not so much wait on everyone else, but we individually, I mean, like Reality Exploit Roundtable is just another implementation of people getting together without the state and doing something. And it's not much that we're doing. And everyone can do something and should something, because the future is really there for us to get them to get it and to grasp it and to create it.
I agree. And one of the things you brought out in the book that we didn't talk about, but we'll illustrate right here, that hit me square when I first read it, was that the temporary autonomous zones, the second realm, our culture needs its own culture, our own art, our own music. And so we're going to close out here with a dubstep mix from Ashley Waffle, who is one of our friends in the Pound Agora IRC channel. And this is called Welcome to the Agora.
Necessary for human life and fulfillment. Necessary for human life and fulfillment.
Thank you for listening to the Reality Exploit Roundtable bonus episode on agorism. You can find this episode and the show notes on agoristradio.com, as well as archives of our previous shows.